Welcome to All Sides with Anna Stever. Ohio is spending $24 million to create intellectual diversity centers at 5 public universities. These centers are described as independent academic units, and they're supposed to center around the U.S. Constitution, law, and history. They're going to hire professors, offer classes, eventually even give away degrees, all with the goal of sparking debate, expanding the diversity of ideas on campus, fostering intellectual freedom and mutual respect. That sounds great, right? Well, opponents of these centers say they're designed to push conservative ideas, push back on what Republicans claim is a liberal bias in higher education, and they fear these centers will stifle diversity of thought rather than encourage it. So we decided to spend an hour learning about them, hearing from the people who created them, the people who will run them, and the concerns of those who think that that $24 million could be better spent elsewhere. We begin with Republican State Senator Jerry Serino. He co-sponsored a bill to create 2 of the 5 centers and then worked to get the other 3 into the state budget last summer. Senator Serino, welcome back to All Sides.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with the simple question. Why did you want to create these centers in the first place, and why did you want to house them in our public colleges and universities?
Well, it would be great if we did not need to establish these centers, because as you mentioned earlier, the universities in Ohio, and probably around the country, but let's focus on Ohio, have not done the job of creating an environment where all sides of issues are discussed and debated. They do tend to be liberal, and it's been stipulated even by very liberal magazines and members of the media, that there is a left-of-center bias at our universities, and we have stats and studies to support that. So because of that, we felt it was important to be able to provide a quick means of establishing these centers that will provide a true diversity of thought on campus. It is not just to get conservative ideas across. It is about teaching history. It's about teaching civics. It's about making sure that students are exposed to different sides of issues. And again, it would be great if we did not need to do this. The institutions should have been doing this all along, but we felt it was important that we wanted to see some change quickly, and that establishing these centers within our public universities would be the best way to go. And that's the plan behind it.
So one of them will be located right here at Ohio State University. Where are the other 4?
Well, the other 4 will be Toledo University, it will be Miami University, Wright State, and Cleveland State University.
It's my understanding that Toledo is just getting up and running, but the others will come online later. Is that fair?
They're in the process right now. Lee Strang, who is now taking the job at Ohio State at the Chase Center.
We're going to hear from him later this hour.
All right. He was originally part of Toledo and was just hired by Ohio State just a few weeks ago. And they're in the process of looking for a replacement for him. But I will say that while Lee was there, he made great progress in hiring some faculty, tenure-track faculty, in establishing a curriculum. He'll do the same very quickly at Ohio State, I'm sure. The others are still working on establishing their boards, who'll be tasked with actually hiring the directors, and then the work of developing the academic programs and hiring faculty will begin.
So most of the centers will have 10 faculty. Ohio State gets 15. Go Buckeyes. I want to talk, though, a little bit about the advisory councils. So each center has an advisory council, and they have professors from universities outside of Ohio. So, for example, Ohio State has professors from Arizona State and Princeton. Why did you want to have these councils include people from outside the university?
Well, it was very simple. We did have in the statute, and when we passed it in the budget, that there needs to be a requirement to have some from Ohio, a certain number. But, you know, our goal was to populate these advisory boards who are going to pick the directors, that we wanted to have the very best scholars on the subjects that we are looking to include in the curriculum. And let's face it, not every one of these people is going to come from Ohio. We wanted to find the very best people we could at other universities. Perhaps some of them have even been involved in North Carolina, where they've already established a center, or in Arizona, where they've already established one. So there's a network of people out there who are scholars who have written extensively on the subjects we're talking about being included in these centers. And we just wanted to draw from the very best talent out there.
You also have the directors of these centers report directly to the university president. They don't go through like a provost. They don't go through the normal hierarchy. Why was that important to have them report directly to the president, who then reports directly to the board of trustees?
Well, we were very insistent that these be independent, truly independent institutes within the university setting. So we're not planning on building any buildings, or there's no brick and mortar plan. But we also felt that if given the objective that we have, and given the challenges that the university's faculties have put in front of us in terms of their left-leaning positions, typically, we felt it was really important that we not allow the program and its mission to be in any way diluted by those who might want to take issue with the establishment of the center in the first place.
I want to talk a little bit about the debate that unfolded when you introduced this idea. So you and Senator Rahm Emanuel brought a bill. It was called Senate Bill 117, if anybody wants to look it up. And there was a lot of testimony. It only included Toledo and Ohio State, but we still heard from a lot of folks. And I want to play a cut from the Ohio Conference of the American Association of University Professors. They testified as an interested party, which, for those who don't know, just means they weren't a yes or a no. It means they had some reservations. So here is AAUP's Stephen Maccabee.
We've chosen to agree to disagree with the sponsors of the bill over the need for new institutes to create and facilitate intellectual diversity at our public colleges and universities. Ohio's institutions of higher education are already open marketplaces of ideas where free inquiry is ongoing. We remain deeply concerned that attempts by the General Assembly to override the autonomy of our colleges and universities will have many unintended consequences that damage, not enhance, the climate of free inquiry on our campuses and the quality of education that is offered to our students.
Well, I think Maccabee is living on a different planet than I am. There is no question that the universities have fallen, historically, have fallen short of providing an environment that is neutral and allows for true intellectual diversity. The AAUP is solidly against any kind of reform, and I understand their position completely. They have fought against any reforms that I have introduced. I understand their position, and they have a right to take that position. But for them to suggest that it's already, the university environment is already an open marketplace of all ideas is absolutely ridiculous.
So there was a University of Toledo professor, Benjamin Davis, who submitted testimony. And he said that having professors like Lee Strang, who was at Toledo, who's now come to Ohio State, and others, was proof of intellectual diversity, at least at a place like Toledo.
Well, I've talked with faculty, conservative faculty members all around the state. And I've talked with students as well in the whole run-up to Senate Bill 83. And I can tell you that that is not the case. They are a very, very small minority of faculty. And very often they are ostracized by their peers. And I don't just mean not invited to cocktail parties. I'm talking about they are professionally ostracized if they take a conservative view of anything. And so that environment is wrong. That is not consistent with the Chicago principles. And it is not consistent with what I believe should be the general environment in our institutions of higher education, where students should be presented with different sides of issues, different points of view, and taught how to arrive at their own conclusion. We should be teaching our students how to think, not what to think. And that's what's been going on.
Speaking of those students, I do want to talk about one particular issue, and that when you look at student surveys about, do I feel comfortable sharing my opinion? You do get students who say, no, I don't. But one of the most interesting things to me is when they ask, why? Why do you not feel comfortable? A lot of the time it's, I don't want to lose my friends. It's not the professors. It's the other students in the class that they're worried about.
Well, I understand that. And I've, in the political environment we have in general today in the society in America, families are split with because of political reasons and opinions. And certainly concern with being ostracized or mistreated by fellow students is an issue. And that is the one of the areas that causes self-censorship, which we should not have. But think about it. Those students who make it difficult for conservative students to express themselves, I believe have been stoked by their liberal professors in the first place. We want an environment where anybody can express themselves, not feel that they're going to be in any way physically or socially threatened. that's not the kind of environment that we should be putting our children and grandchildren through.
I have a sort of 30,000 foot view question for you, which is, how do you define civil discourse? What does it look like to you?
Civil discourse to me is, it ought to be pretty simple. You know, I should be able to express my opinion to you, and you have a different view of the same issue with me, and we can have a conversation, a debate. I was a high school debater. And
oh, so was I.
Oh, great. It's great training for what we are both doing now. And if you recall, I'm sure you debated a lot
later. I did policy debate. Did you do that or Lincoln?
We did everything. There's a big time gap between when you were doing it and when I was doing it. But if you recall, and I think it's still the same, you were given a subject and you were told to either take a pro or a
yes.
con position. So whether you really believed it or not, you had to take the other side and take the other position. And what was great about that was not only because not only that you had to be extemporaneous in your thinking and in your responses, you had to think about what the other side was thinking and where were they coming from. That's just political discourse, I think, in the way it should be, without people getting angry. And can you walk out of the room after you've had this debate and go have a cup of coffee together?
Yeah, I think it actually created almost, I don't want to say a detachment from the issues, but this sort of like, we're having a debate. Literally, we're not having an argument.
Right. Right. There's a big difference between a debate and an argument. You can challenge each other's facts. You can challenge each other's opinions and try to make your case. But what it really is about ultimately is trying to persuade the other person. And I think we've lost the art of persuasion in our political discourse today.
I also think that is in part due because you pay such a penalty for changing your mind.
Well, I'm sure we have all changed our mind on different things.
Oh, yeah, for
over
sure.
Time. It shows a
particularly
a level
in
of,
politics. I think you guys get excoriated when you have a change of heart.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. And it goes on. It's regardless of your political party, people should be able to change their minds. But I do think when you change your position on something, there's a responsibility to explain why you changed your mind. Otherwise, it comes across, as we're seeing today in the presidential debate, that your position has changed as a result of something superficial like polls and other
things. It's opportunistic.
It's opportunistic, and I think that's extremely disingenuous.
I want to talk a little bit about these five senators, kind of bring it back to the ground level here. Two were in Senate Bill 117, Ohio State and Toledo. What made you want to add three more to the state budget?
I felt that two was a good starting point for us in Senate Bill 117. And as we were going through the debate on Senate Bill 83 and other discussions on other parts of higher ed that we would like to address, it became clear to me in the final budget discussions that we have an opportunity to really put this concept on steroids. So that's why we decided, you know, should it have been six or seven? I mean, that's somewhat arbitrary. But we felt that adding three more, the three that we did, and we did change Cincinnati to
yeah.
Wright State afterwards.
Because they wanted to continue with their Portman Center.
Right. We didn't know about the Portman thing going on. And so they came to us after we passed the bill and asked us, because we had to pass another bill to remove them. And we changed it to Wright State at their request. Wright State was begging to have one of these centers. And we've had other university presidents ask us to consider them for expansion.
So the budget allocated $24 million for these centers, and we should say they're not building physical buildings. So
right.
$5 million for each fiscal year to Ohio State, $1 million to Toledo, $2 million for Miami and Cleveland, and I believe Wright State. There are concerns, though, that this won't be enough to run these centers. Are you concerned that this could be an underfunded mandate?
Well, I have not heard from any of the participants that they feel there's a risk of underfunding. As you know, it's a biennium funding mechanism. So when we do the operating budget next year, we're going to have to take a look at that. If there's a concern that there is underfunding, we have the opportunity to change that and correct it. We felt pretty strongly that the dollars that we did allocate by institution were going to be adequate. But
and they can
again,
also solicit donations.
They can. And I heard that Ohio State got their first donation. I don't know how much it was. But unless someone else has disclosed that. But I think, you know, we're just getting started here. So
yeah.
I think there's going to be some groups that or individuals who may decide that this is a really good idea, which I think it is, and decide to make some donations.
What would you say to people who are wary about these centers, who are worried that they may push conservative views and try to silence more liberal ideas? Like, what would you say to someone who's hesitant about this going up on their campus?
I would say, that's a great question. I would say that, look, intellectual diversity is not dangerous. It also creates an environment of more speech, not less speech. Some people have criticized this bill and the concept of the five centers by saying it stifles free speech and it stifles academic freedom. And that is just crazy. That is not true. How can more speech threaten speech? It's an impossible thing to do.
That was Republican State Senator Jerry Serino. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we're talking with an Ohio State professor about how the faculty there is reacting to the new Chase Center. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about civic centers being erected on five college campuses here in Ohio. The state has invested $24 million to get them up and running. We just heard from the Republican who legislated them into existence. Now we're going to hear from a professor at Ohio State University where one of these centers will be located. Professor Pranav Jani is the president of Ohio State's chapter of the American Association of University Professors, and he joins us now. Professor Jani, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having me.
The center at Ohio State will be called the Salmon P. Chase Center for Civics, Culture, and Society, and The university recently hired its director, a law professor named Lee Strang. We're going to hear from Professor Strang later this hour, but you've been critical of his appointment. What concerns you about the choice?
I mean, I don't know him personally. I'm sure he has all the qualifications. What concerns me really is, well, two things. One is the center itself. It's really important to understand, for everyone in Ohio, because we're paying for this, that these intellectual diversity centers are rooted in the same kind of project that drives bills like SB 83, which has led to, in Ohio and Texas, the kind of attack on diversity, attack on unions, attack on academic freedom. And so the same logic that drives SB 83 is what drives these intellectual diversity centers. And it's the idea that universities are somehow hotbeds of left-wing and liberal politics, and there needs to be a balance, and that balance needs to come from politicians. That's at the root of it. And so SB 117, which produced these centers, is a spinoff of SB 83. They couldn't pass SB 83. They're still going to try, but they got this into the budget, and it's kind of taking a piece of that. And so my first opposition is to the entire project itself. I think intellectual diversity thrives at universities. I think it's redundant and a waste of money, frankly. I think the second issue has to do with this appointment. Professor Strang, it's not a random appointment. He's the architect of this entire plan of these intellectual diversity centers. He's a known conservative. He's anti-abortion. He has an originalist concept of the Constitution. It's not a sort of a neutral person running an intellectual diversity center.
As executive director, Strang is going to be responsible for organizing the center, hiring the faculty, developing curriculum, delivering academic programming. It sounds like you have concerns about the kind of programming he is going to push for.
I'm sure they have an investment in bringing in people from different kinds of political ideas and research projects in order to show diversity and things like that. So they have an investment in showing that this will work. But I think there's two concerns here. One is, will the center follow due process in terms of established patterns of hiring, of curriculum? We don't just hire people. We don't just set up classes. We actually have to go through all of these processes, and many centers take years to develop, right? And so there's a question of due process and fairness. And I think there's a second question of who decides whether something is diverse enough. if Lee Strang is going to say, well, we're going to have people from this view, and that view, well, those may not be diverse. They might not be that nuanced. They might be diverse from a particular point of view, but not diverse from another. And so I think there's a bunch of questions on even this very kind of amorphous idea of intellectual diversity and what it means. When do we know we have it? I don't think that question has really been answered.
The structure of this is also different from other places at Ohio State in mm-hmm. that the director of the Chase Center reports directly to President Ted Carter, bypassing mm-hmm. some of the traditional hierarchy like provosts. And mm-hmm. there was a special counsel created that includes right. professors from all over the country who then initially picked Strang in the first place. So his hiring and his hierarchy are different than traditional right. professors at Ohio State.
Right. And this is just an example of the way that, the legislature has kind of stretched his hand way too far, right? And so you have the state directly trying to kind of micromanage what happens within universities. And we know in all kinds of, from corporations to all kinds of institutions, that doesn't lead to good results. And so rather than something organic, exactly what you described, rather than an organic process in which people in the university community actually participate in choosing the kinds of classes and the kind of hiring that happens at a university, you have people from the outside. And so if you think about, again, if we go back to the logic that I said is the driving logic of this, what they would say is, well, the university is already somehow has caught the contagion, right, of left-wing and liberal thought. So if the university picks people, their argument would be, we'll just get the same old, same old. So we need outside people to correct that. And I think that's the premise we need to go after if we're really going to challenge this. It's not just about due process. It's about this idea that the university needs to be managed and disciplined from the outside. That whole question of the outsider makes me think of how when other political arguments come up, then the outsider is the problem, right? So when we see all of these debates about ballot initiatives, then Republicans are always saying, oh, there's outside interests and outside money that's shaping what happens in our state. Here, because they have an interest in doing it the other way, the argument will be outsiders are good because they'll bring objectivity, that the university can't find in itself. So it's based on a false premise. But once you accept the false premise, then you can justify all of this stuff.
I want to ask you some broader questions
sure.
about life on college campuses. Do you yeah. think there is a liberal bias on college campuses?
No, I don't think there's a liberal bias. I think that what's happening is two different things. And this is a complicated question, but I'm trying to be brief and concise, right? But this is a great question to ask, and we should all be asking this. I think there's two kinds of things we have to think about. So on the one hand, I think what they're doing is they're ascribing the kinds of, we're in a period of movements, right? If you think since the economic crisis of 2008, and you think of Occupy, and you think of Black Lives Matter, and you think of all of these different movements, and now around Palestine, we're in a moment where movements have come back to university campuses the way they were in the 60s and 70s. And so there's a shift among youth, and that's being somehow ascribed to us professors teaching them that, right? When actually in our classrooms, if you actually come into our classrooms, they're arguing with us. They think we kind of have old-fashioned ideas, and they're actually arguing with us and trying to, find room for themselves. And professors like me, we love that. We say, great. Go ahead and fly. We want you to open your wings and just fly, right? That's how we treat our students in Ohio, right? Each one of those students is precious to me, and I want them to develop to their full potential. So I think we're seeing a shift in youth which says, let's get involved in the world and let's be active about it. And I think that's something that the far right is scared of. I think the second thing that's happening is that a few classes and concepts within the humanities and maybe in the sciences in terms of climate change, which is not a concept anymore, right? It's a proven fact. But this idea of climate change, I think they've been threatened by the pedagogical changes that have happened in the university since the 1960s and 70s, where we talk about structural racism, we talk about patriarchy, we talk about empire. kids in school learn about the Native Americans today. When I grew up in school, we never talked about Native Americans, you know? And so there's like a new consciousness that's happened, and that's expressed in some of humanities classes and social sciences. But you look at the rest of the university, I mean, these are systems that are pretty much entrenched within existing society. They work with corporations. They do a lot of mainstream stuff. So it's not really the whole university, but they find it convenient to take particular concepts and classes in the humanities and social sciences and use that as a wedge to make a larger argument about what's wrong with U.S. society. And so I really think that that's the kind of thing that's going on. So I do think we actually see a wider diversity of views on college campuses than we see in the outside world. I think actually that proves the point that we already have intellectual diversity. But you take the rally yesterday at the pro-Palestine rally yesterday. It can look like, wow, they're all, you know, radicals or something. There were 200 people there. It's not like the majority of Ohio State students showed up or something like that. You know, it was a good rally, but there are only 200 people there. And so the fact that there's a wide range of ideas and practices on college campuses is then used to say, well, universities are the problem.
The University of Chapel Hill in North Carolina has a similar center that's already been set up. It's called the School of Civic Life and Leadership. And I've been learning about its director. His name is Jed Atkins. And he says that we have a civics crisis in America, that it is increasingly hard to have civil discussions with people who have different views. And I do wonder if you feel that. I mean, as somebody who covers politics, I do feel like we're getting more tribalistic, more partisan.
I know what you mean. And I think we should think about whether that's because of universities or not. You know, we have this whole phenomenon of social media, right? I always say that we have this very interesting moment right now that we're living in, where on the one hand, holistically, and they say, what, you know, how's your mental health? And, you know, let's look at the whole person, right? Not just one aspect of a person. But then we have this vehicle of social media, which reduces people to a single idea or a single statement. And then that becomes this huge thing of like, this is what you stand for. And it's like, no, it was just a thought, you know? And so I feel like before we would just think things and now we put them down and all of a sudden it becomes this big. So I think there's a larger phenomenon that our society is grappling with, right? I think that's definitely true. I think it comes out of a lot of things like, you know, crises in an economy that continues to churn out, you know, lots of wealth, but then a lot of people are left behind. I think there's a lot of different things motivating this crisis. But I do think that in classrooms, I mean, I love when a student who doesn't agree with me, and this happens frequently, they say they love my class. Because in my class, they feel they could learn something new, learn something they haven't heard about. You know, I also don't hide my positions. I just tell them, you're not graded on my positions. You're graded on your ability to research, to read, to think, and to make arguments, right? I'm an English teacher. And I feel like in my classes, you actually see people with very different points of view talk to each other, debate with each other, and do it in a way that doesn't just kind of explode, right? They might dislike each other. They might not be friends, but they're able to have some of those things. So I do think we have a crisis, but I also think that there are places where actual conversation and dialogue is happening. I do it every single day of my life. I also think that the people who are pointing to the crisis are themselves people who light fires all the time.
I want to ask you a little bit about students in particular, because one of the things I find interesting is in preparation for this show, I was looking at some student surveys, like, do you feel comfortable sharing opinions in the classroom? And they're from all over the country. And one of the things that I found interesting is there's a cohort that says they do not feel comfortable sharing their opinions. And they say the reason why is not the professor, but their peers, that they're worried about being recorded and put on social media. They're worried about being ostracized for maybe having an opinion that differs from their friends. I don't know how we correct for that.
Yeah, I think, and that exactly connects with what I was talking about, which is that it's a larger problem that we have to come up with. We have to figure out as a society, how are people going to be able to talk to each other, debate with each other, dialogue, which isn't necessarily debate. And at the same time, I think what this generation has done really well is that when they're hurt by something, they express it. And I feel like for me, it was like absorb, absorb, absorb. And so all you do is pile up, right? All these kinds of things that you've never said. And then they come out in other, you know, in ways that are not productive. So I think we should make, you know, not that you're doing it, but I think sometimes we throw this generation under the bus. They teach me so much. They are so curious. I can't even describe, you know, I'll be teaching a 4,000 level English class in my field, which is post-colonial studies, where we talk about the world that Britain colonized and the literature coming from it. And many times students don't know it's a 4,000 level. They're very smart, but they haven't been exposed to some basic things about geography and world history. And I can't tell you how hungry they are to learn and to see things from a different point of view. There's nothing wrong with our students. Our students are golden. I think the problem is we've created a society in which people are pitted against one another rather than expressing actually what they genuinely feel. I think these protests and things like that that are being seen sometimes as violent and all that, that's people expressing what they feel, you know, and they're trying to put their ideas into practice, but they get written off, you know, they get demonized and things like that. So I think like it's a complicated topic, so I'm going all over the place too. But I think I would come back and say, I think we do have things to learn from this generation. I think there's something about social media and there's something about isolation right now that we also need to very carefully address. And, you know, then it becomes violence, right? Whether we talk about gun violence in schools or other sorts of things. So there's a lot for us to figure out. But the kind of, you know, J.D. Vance kind of professors are the enemy thing, it's just an attempt to scapegoat us, you know, as somehow creating, you know, these issues.
That was Professor Pranav Dani, president of Ohio State's chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Coming up, we're talking with the director of Ohio State's new Chase Center. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Saver. We're talking about the five intellectual diversity centers being built at five different public colleges here in Ohio. Earlier, we heard from a lawmaker who created them. Now we're turning our attention to the Ohio State and the new executive director of the Salmon Chase Center for Civics, Culture, and Society at Ohio State University's John Glenn College of Public Affairs. His name is Professor Lee Strang, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Anna.
Professor, you kind of got the ball rolling on this idea when you were a law professor at the University of Toledo. I understand you were inspired by visits to Georgetown and Princeton. So what was it about those places, the centers they had there, that made you say, we need to do this in Ohio?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I first started teaching law back in 2004. And the reason why I went into legal education was not to make a lot of money, because lawyers in private practice make multiples. It's because as a young person growing up in America, I became really interested in our Constitution, and I had a lot of questions. So what does it mean on particular issues that Americans debate about? How do we even answer those questions? And so I was looking for a place where I could spend the time in a community of scholars through the give and take of scholarship, making arguments, counterarguments, refining arguments, and come to some conclusions myself. And so since 2004, that's what I've been doing, and I love my life as a scholar. The project on constitutional interpretation culminated in a book in 2019 by Cambridge Press called Originalism's Promise, and it's a modified originalist approach to constitutional interpretation. What I saw, though, Anna, was in, 2015, that the ability of higher ed in America to have what I saw as the core of the academic project, which is debate and discussion within and among disciplines to try and ascertain the truth, started becoming subject to pressure. And I think people might disagree about why or the causes of that, but I think it's a widely held view, at least inside higher ed, that that's a phenomenon. I've heard it from friends at numerous institutions. So there's a point where I went home and spoke with my wife and said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to stay in higher ed, even though it was my passion for years, because this project of the give and take of the scholarly dialogue was becoming less robust. And around that same time, I had the opportunity to spend a year at the James Madison program at Princeton. What I saw there was a revival of my hope in higher ed. What I saw was a center dedicated to multiple disciplinary perspectives, and then multiple perspectives within a discipline, debating, discussing, having conversations over drinks on important issues of law and policy and religion and philosophy. I'll just give you one example. It was a debate between the two leading historians on the question, is the Constitution fundamentally a pro-slavery or pro-freedom document?
Ooh.
And it's an important issue that Americans have and continue to debate about. And we had, on the one side, this great scholar arguing one proposition, and the other side, great scholar arguing a different proposition.
I almost wonder if there's a recording of this I can go listen
to
later.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Go to the James Madison program. One of the things they do very well is to record all of their events. And so I came back after that really refreshed and thinking, I want to do this for my home institution, which was at that time the University of Toledo. And then through a series of serendipitous events, it came out that in partnership with other colleagues and other partners, creation of these five civic centers around Ohio.
The University of Toledo's center and the Ohio State Center were included in a bill called Senate Bill 117, which means there was testimony. People came out in support of them. People came out against them. And I want to play a cut from that testimony. This is Megan Anderson, who was a law student at the University of Toledo at the time and said funding cuts were the real problem in Toledo.
When I applied to law school in 2020, Toledo was ranked 136th in the United States. Last year, our ranking dropped below 147 and into the bottom tier of unranked law schools. These metrics of decline are alarming, and the impacts are felt by students themselves. Bar passage rates have dropped significantly in recent years, which are due to a lack of comprehensive resources and support systems to prepare students for the bar exam, not an alleged lack of intellectual diversity. Unfortunately, SB 117 does not propose addressing the pressing real needs of the University of Toledo College of Law and its students.
So what is your response to people like Megan who say this money could have been better spent elsewhere?
Yeah, that's a great question. Higher ed is a huge, I don't want to say enterprise, it's a huge project of Ohio and all the states in the union. And there are, putting your economist hat on for a minute, there's an unlimited number of wants and a limited supply of resources. So it's always the case that a person can say that resources should be better deployed elsewhere. When you look at polling data of average Americans, what you see is that Americans' trust for higher education is dropping in precipitously. And it's been dropping—
For all civic institutions, really.
For all civic institutions, including higher ed. But here's my point. There are, I think, two specific reasons that are given by the polling respondents in higher education. So one of them is at least the perception, maybe the reality, maybe that's something that people disagree about, but it's at least the perception that higher ed has become one-sided, that it's become a monoculture. And so parents and students are saying, why am I going to spend 4 years and tens of thousands of dollars to send my child to receive only one side of whatever an issue or perspective is? And that's not a money issue. And that's an issue about the way in which higher ed is currently operated in the U.S. Second and related is the value proposition that at spending 4 years and spending tens of thousands of dollars, people want to come out the other side with something that's going to be valuable to them. And if the perception is that what students are receiving is indoctrination or something that is not going to be truly enriching to the student, then parents and students aren't going to go there. Both instances, the reasons for the perception is not a lack of resources. It's a claim about how universities are currently operating and structured. And so centers like the Chase Center, centers like the Toledo Institute for American Constitutional Thought, among many other things, so I think there's intrinsic value to each of these centers, as I talked about earlier, but there's also instrumental value in being a concrete response to the perceptions that people have about higher education. And so what I'd say is that funding may be a problem, but it's not necessarily a criticism of the centers in particular. Instead, the centers, I think, are a legitimate response to some of the criticisms of higher ed more generally.
Do you think some of the lack of discourse is also because college has kind of become this vehicle for going off and getting a good job rather than like part of being a well-rounded citizen?
I think there are a lot of reasons why discourse in higher ed is reduced. So I've taught law now for almost 20 years, and I've taught constitutional law for a large chunk of that. And I would say that the discourse, so my goal in my classes is to provide an environment that models for the students what legal practice is going to be like. What's legal practice going to be like? It's going to be people advocating for their respective positions in a robust yet respectful manner. And I would say I have found challenges in eliciting from students the robust arguments that I want for the positions that I place them in. So it could be a plaintiff or it could be a defendant. And when I talk to students about why that's the case, there's lots of reasons. Some of it deals with social media. But I think a lot of it also deals with the lack of practice that young Americans today have in actually talking, like you and I are talking across the table, about important issues. So these centers are going to be intentional places, not just for civil debate and discussion, which they definitely are going to be. What I'm envisioning is that all of them are going to be genuine academic communities, kind of like I'm the oldest person in this conversation. When I was a young person in college, there's lots of learning going on in the classrooms, but a lot of learning was also going on in the dorm, across the hall, over a pint of beer in the evening. And these centers will be genuine academic communities where those kind of conversations, both online and offline, are occurring. And so young people become in the habit, they gain the skills, they gain the confidence of engaging people across difference.
Let's talk a little bit about the center you're going to run at Ohio State. You're going to hire professors, have classes, eventually have majors and minors. Who do you hope to hire? What kind of classes do you want to offer?
So the Chase Center has a statutory mission, and the core of the statutory mission is research and teaching on the American civic tradition. So what we're going to be looking for are faculty from different disciplinary perspectives. So law is me, history, English, religious studies. All of the bodies of knowledge that young people need in order to be flourishing citizens and whatever path life takes them to. And I think all of those bodies of knowledge are relevant for citizens. So we're going to look for faculty who have excellent credentials, who are going to meet and exceed OSU's research standards, and who are going to together create this genuine academic community. So what classes are we going to offer? I think that's part of a build-out project that's maybe a couple years down the road. And in one step, the step that I'm currently in is trying to understand what are all of the numerous really excellent offerings currently existing at OSU? Because we don't want to duplicate. What we want to do is complement what's going on at
OSU.
They
offer a lot of classes.
There are there are almost 300 classes that have the label citizen or citizenship in them.
Oh, my
goodness. And so trying to make sure that we're not duplicating the good work that's already being done, but offering students this well-rounded, multidisciplinary perspective on what the knowledge one needs to have, the skills that one needs to have, and the disposition that one needs to have to be a full flourishing citizen to carry out the role that one's going to have. And so there's lots of models out there, and we're just not to the point yet where we are able to make firm and concrete decisions about what classes to offer. I can say a few things, right? So one thing we want to do is have a foundational course. I think most of the centers in Ohio will offer a similar foundational course. And the title I have in mind is the American Civic Tradition. So it's going to be a common basis for conversation that all the students are going to have because they're going to have the same class. It'll have things that you and I would definitely, all Americans would understand, the Declaration, the Gettysburg Address, letter from Birmingham Jail, but lots of other things. And also things that are part of the American Civic Tradition that aren't documents, but are practices. So I think one of the interesting practices of us being Americans is we debate about what it means to be an American. And so part of the curriculum is going to be trying to identify ways in which students are introduced to that practice.
You know, when we talk about teaching the story of America, as I've gotten older, I've sort of realized how little of it I learned in school. And I don't know if that's a criticism of public education in general. I had a mix of public and private, so who knows? But I'll give you this example. So we did a show earlier this year about the Lincoln School Marchers. And they were one of the longest sustained civil rights marches in the country. It happened right here in Ohio. It was a group of Black mothers who marched for 2 years to get their local school integrated after Brown versus Board of Education. And the story was almost lost to history simply because nobody put it down until this historical society got together and wanted to share the story. And they managed to get a bunch of the women who are in their 70s, their 80s, who, you know, could have died and the story would have been lost. So when you talk about American civic institution, how do you make sure that those kinds of, like, it's fascinating to me. I was so enthralled to learn that we had one of the longest sustained civil rights marches in the history of the movement right here in Ohio.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary story. And thank you for sharing it. And the story of the Americans for Tradition is incredibly rich, and all of us have things that we don't know, and then when we hear about them, we're enriched by our engagement with those aspects of American history. And so the American Civic Tradition courses and curriculum more broadly, beyond just the civic tradition, we intend to include all of the different disciplinary perspectives and then the different perspectives of people within those disciplines. So one of the courses, just continuing the same theme that you had identified that we'd like to offer, would be African-American political thought. So Frederick Douglass would be somebody who's, among other people, whose thought was highlighted, and it would be a way to bring to the fore all of the aspects of the American civic tradition, including some that many of us might not have received when we were in high school or maybe earlier in college. One of the things that we're also working on, and this is something that we're exploring, it's not definitive yet, is we're looking for concrete research opportunities for our students. We want our students to have research and writing experience that they can, it's intrinsically valuable, but it's also valuable for them with employers. And one conversation we've had is with something called the Quill Project. It's out of Pembroke College in Oxford. And what the Quill Project does, and what we would do here in Ohio, is we would make publicly accessible the documentary record of the Ohio constitutional tradition. And you can go to libraries and find big old dusty books and open them up, but it's hard for people to do. And as a lawyer, I'm able to do that, but it does take a lot of time. But what we want to do with the Quill Project is to bring to light history that otherwise would be inaccessible to people. So what you're describing is something that we want to do. I'm not exactly sure what form that's going to take, but it's definitely a valuable project.
The lead up to the 1851 convention, we covered in our redistricting series because it was largely redistricting that led to it. Such a wild set of stories.
Mid-19th century America is a wild time.
So when you look at student surveys about whether they feel comfortable sharing opinions in the classroom, a lot of them say they self-censor, but it's not because necessarily the professor makes them feel uncomfortable, but a non-insignificant number of them say it's because they're worried about what their peers will think. And I feel like that is a difficult thing to correct for. So how will you try to make people feel more comfortable sharing a controversial opinion with their friends?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one, I would say, I've come towards the conclusion that you've identified as the reason why many students self-censor after having just numerous conversations with students over the years, relating back to my earlier comment where my perception is that in my law school classroom, the debates and discussions have become less robust over time. Why is that? I know that you have views on this, and the social media is one common theme that I've heard, the negative response on social media to, did you hear what such and such person said? So there's a general way in which I think the Chase Center and other centers will be able to respond, and then there's some concrete examples. The general way is to create a culture, right? So the culture we have now is one of self-censorship. The one is, hey, you've said something that I disagree with, I'm going to pound you on social media. And that's a very unhealthy culture. It's one that leads to lots of pathologies. And so what we have to do is create, and this is the goal of the Chase Center, a genuine academic community where people in that community know it's par for the course that you're going to say things that I disagree with, and it's not par for the course for me to say something negative to you on social media. So how do you do that concretely? One way I think, and this is something that I've learned from some of the events that we've done, is you signal through your public statements what kind of community we have. So one of the events that we had put on at the Institute for American Constitutional Thought was a debate on whether Donald Trump is eligible for office. And it's, as you might imagine,
contentious debate.
An issue about which many people are very passionate. And so I was genuinely concerned, would people be more than civil? Would people become uncivil in that context? And so we, through many mechanisms, messaged what our expectations are. We asked people to rise to their better angels. And so in our introductory comments, in introducing the conversation, in my remarks, and when I started soliciting questions, I reminded people that we're fellow citizens together engaged in the common project of self-government, that we expect to disagree with the person next to us. That doesn't make the person next to us a bad person. It means that they have a different view than us.
Final question for you. What will success look like?
That's a great question. It's one I was actually thinking about today. And the kind of business hat person, putting my business hat on, we want to have measurable metrics, right? We want to say that we have this many graduates who are doing these many things. And I think all that's true. What really touches my heart, and this comes from another hat that I wear, which I'm a president for the first classical charter school in Ohio. Classical education focuses on the Western tradition, history, reading, writing, oral presentation, is when we had our first graduating class, and I saw the parents, and I saw the joy the parents had for the young men and women who were in our first graduating class. And those young men and women were going and doing all the things that you'd want young Americans to do. They were going off to college. They were going off to vocational school. They were going to serve their country in the military. They were going off into the workforce. And the parents were delighted that their young people had given the knowledge, the skills, and disposition to do all that. So for me, what's going to be most powerful is when we have students who graduate and go out and pursue their vocation, whatever that vocation is, and do so in an excellent way. And then we get a note back like, hey, I just had this really interesting success. And that's what I think will be the most important example of success, is that the individuals living out their lives to the fullest degree possible.
That was Professor Lee Strang, the new head of Ohio State's Intellectual Diversity Center, being housed at the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. Thank you for your time today.
It's my pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.